Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. I'm David Ewing Duncan, Chief Correspondent for Public Radio's Biotech Nation and author of Experimental Man, What One Man's Body Reveals About His Future, and I'm this evening's moderator. Tonight, we're here to listen to some amazing but true tales with Inforum's program tonight titled My Life is an Experiment, A Year of Living Biblically, and More. And believe me, there is more. A.J. Jacobs, acclaimed journalist and best-selling author, is here to dish on his experimental and experiential undertakings as a journalist, from outsourcing his life to going undercover as a beautiful woman.
That's true.
To literally following the rules of the Bible. So let's open up our ears and our minds, and this is going to be a lot of fun tonight, and let's get started with this. So tonight we host A.J. Jacobs, who has taken journalistic commitment to a whole new level, both as editor-at-large of Esquire magazine and as an author of a number of best-selling books, the latest being The Guinea Pig Diaries, My Life as an Experiment. I guess we all live lives as an experiment, but A.J. has taken this to a rather extreme potential here. Anyway, let's get started here with questions right away, and towards the end here, we'd love for you all to join the conversation. My first question, A.J., is, having done a little bit of experimentation myself, and this is a question that I get all the time, why?
Well, I am. I'm delighted to be talking to a fellow self-experimenter. And I guess it comes down to the fact that I think it's one of the best ways to learn about a topic, but even more than that, it's one of the best ways to improve your life. So, for instance, there was a project I did called The Year of Living Biblically. And this one was where I tried to follow all the rules of the Bible for a year. And I mean all of them, not just the Ten Commandments, but also not shaving the beard and stoning adulterers, just from A to Z. So, and it was a wild year and fascinating. I learned a lot, but I've also taken away so much from it that has changed my life for good. And just to give you one quick example, Thanksgiving, gratitude. I was saying during my biblical year all these prayers of thanksgiving because that's what the Bible tells us to do. And I started to realize there are hundreds of things that go right every day that we just gloss over and take for granted. And we focus on the three or four that go wrong. So it radically changed my perspective. And that's why I do these things, is almost to get a fresh perspective on life.
Well, what's really going on here, though, AJ? I mean, you know, this is one journalist to another here, okay? And we'll share this with others. But, I mean, ultimately, we're out to get a great story. That's what we do, right?
Right.
I mean, was that your original motivation? But, you know, you've taken this almost to the level of an addict at this point.
I do. I feel I'm addicted. Well, of course, a lot of it is that I'm a writer. And as we were talking before backstage, you know, neither of us had a particularly outrageous childhood. You know, I'm not the son of carny workers, or you know, my father had an occasional glass of wine. So I'm not going to be writing about my childhood, but I want to make my life interesting by diving into these fascinating topics and living them. So certainly the writing is a motivation, but changing my life is equally a strong goal.
Is that something that developed out of this? I know I read that the first experiment that you did, if you will, was several years ago, and involved Lazy Boy chairs.
Right. This one
Tell
was
us about that.
This was sort of the when I first glimpsed the possibility of this kind of writing. It was that I worked at a magazine called Entertainment Weekly that covered movies and TV, and and Lazy Boy had just come out with the most sophisticated chair in chair history. It was a refrigerator was in there and a butt massager, everything but an outboard motor. So the idea was to push the limits of luxury and leisure to its absolute limits and have me sit in the chair for 24 hours watching TV. And actually, you know, that was not the most illuminating experiment in the history of experiments, but it did give me a sense of this type of journalism. And I'd always been a fan of George Plimpton, and there's a long history of the book Black Like Me, where the writer chemically darkened his skin and went around 1950s South to see what it was like to be a black man. So there's a long history of this type of journalism, and I feel so lucky to be able to make a living like this.
Touché, yes, exactly. And you mentioned in the book Nellie Bly as well. And for people that don't know Nellie Bly, she was a 19th century writer who I think may have invented this, although I'm sure if I go back in history, someone else undoubtedly did it. But among other things, she took Jules Verne's book Around the World in 80 Days literally, and I'm not sure, did she make it in 80 days?
I believe she did.
Yeah.
That's right.
But then she did something that was a bit dangerous. She had herself committed to the New York City Insane Asylum. This is in 1887, and that was not a pretty place at that time.
Right, she exposed the abuses, yeah.
Yeah.
Really a remarkable woman. I can't believe there's not a movie about her.
There we go.
Seems, yeah.
Well, there are a couple movies being made out of your book, but would you ever take that kind of dangerous route in this reporting? I mean, most of what you're doing, I don't know, it might be psychically somewhat damaging at times, which we'll get into. But, I mean, she really actually risked potentially her life because the way they treated people in those days, and maybe she, I was thinking, you know, would she get trapped in there?
Yeah, no, it certainly was dangerous. I mean, I think my specialty is more the intellectually and socially dangerous. So I don't put my, like George Plimpton, you know, got punched by a boxer. But I go and try to push these social situations to the extreme. And, you know, it can be pretty awkward, dangerous to my marriage, as we were discussing backstage.
Now, we'll get into that in a minute. But is there anything that you would not do?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a lot. First of all, I have to get veto power from my wife. So I get a lot of suggestions from readers on what I should do next. And one suggested that I do all the positions in the Kama Sutra and write about that. But my wife put the kibosh on that pretty quickly, which is okay by me. I actually did not want to do it. It seems like a lot of work, a lot of stretching that might might be painful.
Potentially dangerous.
Yeah, that would be physically dangerous. So, yeah, there are certainly ones that that I don't do.
But wasn't that in exchange for giving your wife foot rubs for a year?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, yeah, that's sort of what we settled on.
I don't know who gets the best end of the bargain on that one. So what I'd like to do here is talk about some of your stories and just sort of fire some questions at you. And the Bible, the year of living biblically, did you actually stone any adulterers? I hope they're none here tonight. I see a pile of stones here.
I was able to stone one adulterer, yes.
You were?
That's right. That one, yeah, I was in Central Park at the time, and I was wearing, at the time I was really trying to get into the biblical character, so I had on my robes and my sandal, and I had a huge beard, and the man came up to me, an elderly man actually. He said, "Why are you dressed like that?" And I explained to him, "I'm trying to follow everything in the Bible, from the Ten Commandments right on down to stoning adulterers." And he said, "Well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that'll be great." So, I mean, he offered. So then at that point, I took out a handful of stones that I had been carrying around because I had been hoping to run into an adulterer for quite some time. And this was sort of a lovely coincidence. And he actually was a very aggressive adulterer. He grabbed the stones out of my hand and threw them at my face. So I felt an eye for an eye, the Hebrew scriptures say, I can throw one back at him. So that was how I stoned. And it was obviously a bizarre experience, but it did allow me to wrestle with some of the more profound profound issues that I struggled with in the book, because that was the whole idea of the book, is really to wrestle with these big issues like religion through an interesting point of view. One of the big ones was, how can the Bible be so wise and compassionate and wonderful in some places, and so seemingly barbaric and atavistic in other places? So that was sort of the time when I really got to wrestle with that.
And I guess, we think of fundamentalists, but you were a sort of extreme fundamentalist, because not everyone follows that stricture in the Bible. There's a certain selectivity, I guess, with modern
Absolutely. I mean, that was what I found, and that was one of the big themes of the book, is that fundamentalists say that they are doing everything in the Bible literally. They're following everything. But they pick and choose. We all pick and choose from the Bible. And fundamentalists will say this is a bad thing. They'll say, oh, you're just practicing cafeteria religion. But my response is, what's wrong with cafeterias? I've had some delicious meals at cafeterias. There are some very nice ones out there. So it's all about what you choose from the Bible, the parts, what dishes you take out of the cafeteria. Because in the Bible, there's wonderful things about compassion, loving your neighbor, embracing the outcasts. But there's also a lot of sexism, a lot of homophobia. So it really is where you concentrate. So we have to wrestle with the Bible ourselves.
There's also a lot of smiting. Did you ever smite anyone?
I never got around to smite.
I guess God is supposed to do it.
Yeah, that's true. God is more of a smiter. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's also just one more question on that. How many oxen did you sacrifice?
Yeah, that was a difficult one, sacrificing the oxen. I mean, the closest I came actually was part of the year was I embedded myself with lots of different religious communities to see how they took the Bible literally. So I spent a lot of time with Hasidic Jews and evangelical Christians, and I think I might be the first person to out-Bible talk a Jehovah's Witness. That was very exciting, because he came over to my apartment, and after 3.5 hours, he looked at his watch, and he's like, I got to go. I can't take this anymore. But anyway, the closest thing to sacrifice in modern day New York is a ritual that some Orthodox Jews practice, where you take a live chicken and you sort of say a prayer, and you actually hold it over your head, and then the chicken is slaughtered in front of you. So that was the closest I came to sacrifice.
Now, again, back in this whole addiction that you have to participatory journalism, wouldn't it be easier to find some spiritualism or explore things like sacredness and religion, without growing a beard? I love reading about the avoiding clothes with mixed fibers as well.
I'm
not sure what that means.
Well, that's in the Bible. It says that you cannot wear clothes made of mixed fibers. So I had to get rid of all of my poly cotton clothes. And, that was the fascinating thing. That's why I'm glad that I did it and I followed every rule. Because even those rules that seemed absurd and meaningless on the surface, some of them actually took on meaning and profundity for me by the end of the year, and I could understand how important they are to some communities.
Now, I think you said that you are still sinning, but
oh,
maybe
sure.
30% less or so.
That's true. Well, that was one of.
What did you come away with, actually?
I mean, lots of things, but as you say, I still sin. It was certainly a wake-up call to see how much we sin, how much we lie. The Bible says no lying, no coveting, no gossiping. I live in New York City, and I work in the media. So, that's like 70% of my day. So it was incredibly challenging to try to get rid of that, and I never did. But in trying, I do think I became a better person. And one of the big lessons of the year, by the way, is that to become a better person, one method is to pretend to be a better person. It's all about behavior shaping your thoughts, which they discuss in cognitive behavioral psychology. You act in a certain way, and you start to think in that way. So you pretend to be a compassionate person. You force yourself to visit your friend in the hospital, and you almost trick your mind, and your mind starts thinking, oh, I am a compassionate person. The simplest example is when you force yourself to smile, you become happier. You know, that's a psychological fact. It's sort of a way of tricking your mind. So that was one of the big lessons of the year, how behavior shapes our thoughts.
I guess in the sense that religion teaches you a way of life, hopefully a better way of life, maybe that's one of the lessons learned then.
Right, and I do think, in the end, my wife and I did join a synagogue, and it's a Reform synagogue, and we never go, but...
but you joined.
But we joined, because I thought I wanted to give my kids just a little taste of religion. And I do think religion is a tool. It can be used for good, or it can be used for incredible ill. So I don't think religion is good or bad in essence. It's all about how you use it.
And you didn't keep the beard, obviously.
Well, technically I did keep the beard. It's in a plastic bag at home. but I won't go into that too much detail. My wife keeps it far away, hidden in the back of the room.
We're okay with not getting into that too much. okay, so moving on here, the current book, which is divided up into chapters, it's not devoted to just one topic. I was very intrigued by some of the characters in the book, including Honey from India. And AJ actually outsourced his life to India and read Tom Friedman's book. Tell us about that. You started with some obvious things, I suppose, you know, helping you with stories, researching, things like
right.
that. But then you actually, at one point, outsourced your neuroses.
I did. The idea was to see how much I could outsource my life. You know, I had read Tom Friedman's book and was interested in this phenomenon. So could I outsource everything in my life? So I did. I outsourced my emails. I outsourced my phone calls. And this was, by the way, a team of people in Bangalore, India. They were working for me. I hired them. So they did my phone calls, my email. They argued with my wife for me. They read bedtime stories to my son. And as you mentioned, at one point I was very worried about, it was a book deal. And so I outsourced my worry. I asked them to worry for me. And they wrote back, do not worry, we are worrying. And it was very freeing and liberating.
And this was pretty reasonable too, right? And you actually still have at least one of them on retainer.
That's true. Yeah, the prices vary. You can get them, an assistant, overseas assistant now for about $20 an hour, $10 to $20 an hour. So depending on what you need, it can definitely be reasonable.
Can you outsource a book tour or presentation?
Yeah, I'm not actually here. This is
being done through Bangalore. Another intriguing chapter, they're all fabulous, but was getting your picture taken naked. And you were doing an article with a starlet, right?
Right. This one came about because I work at Esquire magazine.
Right.
And my boss at Esquire wanted to have a picture of the actress Mary Louise Parker in the magazine, and he wanted her to be nude. And she said that she would, but only on one condition, that the person who was editing the article would also pose nude for a photo so that he could feel the objectification. He could go through what she went through. And unfortunately, I happened to be that editor. And so my boss told me, take off your pants, take off your shirt. And there I was in front of a camera, totally exposed and vulnerable, and really getting an insight into what, as a magazine editor, I'm sure I had subjected
participatory editing?
There you go, yeah. Participatory editing.
Now, in fact, the picture, for those of you that want to buy the book or even thumb through it, is actually in there.
That's right. You don't have to look at it, but it is in there.
Yeah. No, it is interesting because I actually had that experience myself. An early article in Wired magazine. I had to go down to L.A. and have my picture.
What was the article about?
It was about genetics. And the photographer got the brilliant idea of, I'm exposing myself. And it was very strange. And I'm not even sure why I said yes. It was sort of a
And did they cover up the naughty bits when it first printed on
Wired? Yeah, digitally.
digitally. Wow.
Anyway, moving right along here. In fact, that gets us right into the next topic that I found really interesting, which is radical honesty.
Yeah, this was one of the most fascinating experiments, because these experiments that I did, I just tried to explore different parts of life that interested me, and honesty definitely interested me, because I felt I did a lot of lying, you know, not evil lies, but a lot of half lies and shading the truth, white lies. So I thought, I found this man who had started a movement called Radical Honesty, which he has thousands of followers, and he lives in Virginia. He's a psychologist. He believes that we should never lie, but more than that, whatever's on our brain should come out of our mouth, no filter. So Kanye West is an example of what he's a radically honest person. So he's a poster child for the perils of radical honesty. But there are also advantages to it. There are also parts of it that are really interesting and do enhance your life. There are parts that really make your life a disaster. And, you know, there were quite a few Category 5 storms in my social life when I engaged in this.
Well, you point out that, I don't know where you got this information, but every 3 minutes or something, men think about sex.
That
so when you're doing
true.
An unfiltered... talking about sex every 3 minutes?
Unfortunately, there is a fine line between radical honesty and creepiness. Yeah. And, I do believe I crossed that line a couple of times. You know, I would say to my friend, oh, I find your wife very attractive. But then he would respond and say, I think your wife is hot. And then we would have a key party. No, we didn't actually do that. But it was very interesting just in terms of human dynamics. When you were radically honest with other people, they would become radically honest with you. So if you want someone to tell the truth, you should, you know, you can open yourself up and become incredibly vulnerable. And that's actually... I think it's an old journalist's trick is that, you know, you tell an embarrassing story about yourself, and then the subject tells an embarrassing story about himself or herself. Unfortunately for the subject, your story is never printed in the magazine, but his is. So it's sort of an old trick.
Unless you pose naked.
That's right.
Yes. Well, you talked, too, about something. When I was getting brain scans of behavior and all of that, it was interesting how that peeled back a lot of myself. You know, we all have different versions of ourselves that we portray to the world, you know, to our close friends and, you know, loved ones, to our colleagues, to people that we don't know very well. And you mentioned that you found, with radical honesty, versions of yourself merging, because essentially you became one self, which was to always say whatever you thought.
Right. That's the argument of Brad Blanton, is that with radical honesty, you will have highs and you will have lows, but you will live a completely authentic existence. I personally don't practice radical honesty anymore. I practice sustainable radical honesty, I call it, because I think it's too dangerous. And the merging of yourself is interesting, because it's not like I kept secrets from one group to another. You know, whatever I said to my guy friends, I was saying to my women friends. Whatever I was saying to, you know, I actually don't spend any time in locker rooms. But if I did, then, you know, I would be saying the same thing to my boss.
So I like the idea of sustainability, because that seems to be a big theme right now with radical honesty. But you said you did draw the line even during the experiment. And by the way, most of these lasted for about a month, right?
Right, that's right.
Okay. But you did draw the line at being radically honest about other people's flaws, especially you tell a story in the book of somebody who's, I think, one of their wife had just died or something, and you know, you couldn't, and they sent you a poem, which I guess was awful, but you didn't feel like you could be radically honest and tell them that. And in fact, Brad Blanton, who is the, you know, the guru of radical honesty, was getting after you for that.
Oh, yeah, we had a lot of conflict, because I refused to tear this guy's dreams down by, you know, he's a lovely man, a recent widower. But Brad Blanton thought that I was being inauthentic. And his point was that I thought I was being compassionate, but the true compassionate thing would be to tell him the truth so he doesn't waste his time being a poet anymore. I still disagree, but the man is true. He's literally true to his word. He's a fascinating character.
Yeah. So say something unfiltered right now. I mean, what are you thinking about right now?
I want to take a nap.
Oh, it's that exciting.
Yeah.
See, look, I give it right back. Okay.
Okay. I woke up at 4 in the morning, so yeah, there you go.
So let's talk about the rationality project. And I found, you know, all of these things were fascinating. But you try to be rational. And I think we're finding out, especially with the economy right now, and basically all economic theory seems to be in the toilet, which assumed a certain rational behavior. We've got wars, you know, et cetera. What was that all about? I mean, why would you want to be rational?
Well, this was one of my favorite projects. I fell in love with the topic because it became clear very early on how irrational human beings are, and that we weren't even built to be rational, and that our brains are still stuck in the Stone Age, and we live in this Silicon Age world. So what I did was I tried to analyze every decision throughout the day and try to eliminate all of the cognitive errors. And one revelation was just how many of our decisions are based on laziness and inertia. And just to give you the simplest example, first thing I did was I got up, I brushed my teeth. I had been brushing with the same toothpaste for 30 years, and that choice I made 30 years ago was not because I thought about pros and cons. It was because some guy at my summer camp in my bunk was brushing with Colgate, and I said, all right, he seems cool, I'll brush with Colgate. And then, but what I hadn't focused on is that I hate the taste of Colgate. It's repulsive. It tastes medicinal and very minty to me. Hope no one works for Colgate. I apologize in advance. But then, you know, when I decided I'm going to try to find a toothpaste that I actually like, that makes rational sense for me. And I found this wonderful toothpaste that's apricot flavored. And every morning it's like a little treat, a little like explosion of taste in my mouth. And, you know, it's changed my life for the better in just a little tiny way. But those little tiny ways really add up. So that was just one example of how irrational, how much of our lives are ruled by habits. And sometimes those habits are good, but a lot of times they're not.
So you also talk about, in an almost philosophical way, about being a journalist and rationality. And in fact, even your experiments, in a sense, are extremes.
Right.
And, you know, trying to, I guess, rationalize what you were doing, maybe being rational or not rational.
Well, I certainly think that the media makes us incredibly irrational. I mean, it plays into the psychologists have come up with a list of what they call cognitive biases, which are these things that distort our thinking. And one of them is called the availability fallacy. And this is that our brains are lazy, and we just take the information that's closest at hand and most vivid, even if it's not the most accurate. So an easy example of this is plane crashes. We focus on plane crashes because they're vivid and emotional and horrible. But statistically, you're 84 times more likely to be killed in a car crash than in a plane crash. But when you ask people what are their greatest fears, how are they going to die, you know, they always put plane crashes in the top 5 and not car crashes. So, and the media feeds into this because the media likes the exciting, the explosive, the emotionally wrenching. So it really, you have to be very careful when watching the media. Even, this was a scary one, our brains when we hear information, even if we're told that information is wrong, often we'll remember it as right. So even just reading a gossip magazine where they just make up lies, you will often, it's called source amnesia. You will forget where you learned a fact, and you will forget whether it was right or wrong, and you will just ingest it. So a fact from the Wall Street Journal carries as much weight as a fact from the National Enquirer. You know, it's a very scary part of our brain.
Sounds like a description of the healthcare debate.
Right. Yes, now. So there's an example of complete irrationality. Yeah,
exactly. And then there's the chapter called Whipped. Mm. And This is, in some ways, I don't know, is it the opposite of the radical honesty chapter? Or
yeah, that's an excellent way to look at it, absolutely.
And this essentially has you doing everything your wife wants you to do for a month.
Right, and this was actually...
Did you get the foot rubs, by the way?
Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. That was key.
Kama Sutra, though, never really happened.
No. Well, that she would not have wanted. Yeah. But this one was, this wasn't actually suggested by readers, because my wife is a saint, and she puts up with quite a bit. Just to give you one quick example, during the biblical year, the Hebrew scriptures say that you cannot touch women during certain times of the month. And if you take it really literally, it says that you cannot sit on a seat where a woman in her time of month has sat, because then the seat has become impure. So my wife found this offensive, and she sat in every seat in our apartment. And I was forced to stand for much of the year. So that is an example of her getting back at me. But this was sort of a way for her to finally get revenge and have me do everything she wanted for a month. Foot massages, Kate Hudson movies, you name it, I had to do it.
Well, I was going to ask you about your wife. You know, how does she put up with this? I think there was one point where you were doing something about being silent throughout the meal. This is when you were doing your unitasking.
Right.
And so he was avoiding multitasking, and that even included sitting and just eating the meal and not talking.
Which was a wonderful experience, by the way. I recommend it. Not all the time, but you concentrate on the food. It changes the way you eat.
But you sort of sheepishly say at one point, oh, please, dear, you know, this is for the project. And I wonder how many times you say that to her and if she's sort of tired of hearing about that. I mean, she's lived with you. How many years have you been doing this?
I've been doing it, I guess the know-it-all, which is about reading the encyclopedia, came out in 2004. So I've been doing it about 5-6 years. But yeah, no, she's a saint, and she, you know, sometimes she won't put up with it and puts her foot down, like with the Kama Sutra. You mentioned Wired. This one was a project that never got off the ground because she put the kibosh on it. I'm fascinated by technology and how it's changing human interaction. So are we missing anything by cutting back so much on face-to-face interaction? So I thought maybe it'd be interesting to push it and just interact through technology, through IM, Facebook. And she's like, no. She said, your niece's bat mitzvah is coming up, and you're not going to Skype your way to the bat mitzvah. You know, you're going to show up in person. You're not going to show up on a video screen at the table.
What else did she veto, having her veto power?
Well, it's interesting. She never censors the books. She, in the first book, The Know-It-All, she read it, and she took out a tiny bit about our sex life, which I think America can thank her for. But but then in the second one, she just left it go. I think it's partly because the reader feedback that I get is so positive towards her and how much of a saint she is that it sort of has validated her.
So she loves a sort of vicarious, participatory.
That's right.
End of things.
And that's also she says I'm not going to participate. She's almost like the control. If this were a scientific study, she's the control.
Uh-huh. Now I'm wondering though, on this experiment of doing everything she wanted, was she okay with having basically a sort of pandering, subservient husband who said yes to everything? I mean, do women want that? Maybe for a month.
But yeah, well, I actually, that was my hope, was that she would see me being a doormat and be like, I want the old pain in the butt, you know, husband back. That never happened. She was happy to have me doing everything she wanted. And I think she loved it because she was able to. One of the things that we did was, at her request, we each wrote down what we did in the marriage around the house and with childcare. And this was a very disturbing exercise, and it's a dangerous one, because I honestly thought before the list that I was pulling my weight. I was doing about half. that did not turn out to be the case. It was like 80%, 20%. And now that it's in black and white, I can never get back to that 80-20. So I am, I always thought those liquid soap dispensers just magically refilled. I had no idea.
They don't?
But it was interesting because it showed, I always assumed I was in a relatively progressive marriage, but even in my marriage, I think that the paradigm from 17th, 18th, 19th century was still in place because women, even in families where women and men both have full-time jobs, the statistics say that women are doing 2.5-3 times the amount of housework and 5 times the amount of childcare. So it's really interesting to me that we're clinging to this old paradigm even though the economy has totally changed.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, start thinking of questions. In about 10 minutes we'll ask you to line up, but we'll keep talking here for a bit. What about this nice guy syndrome along the lines of, I found it fascinating. You talked to, I don't know, a psychologist or psychiatrist, but basically saying, telling you that women don't really want to have a 100% nice guy.
Right. He said, he's actually written a book called Nice Guy Syndrome, and his argument is that men have become too effeminate and that women have gained too much power, and it's the man's job to be the leader in the marriage. And he made the argument that if I really did this, my wife would appreciate it. And I told my wife that, and she said, does he know me? Has he ever met me? You know, she basically dismissed his theory.
So is this stopped now? I mean, after the end of the month, what happened?
Well, yeah, I mean, not to the extent that it went. But as I say, it's hard to go back to the division of labor that we used to have. So it is a fascinating experiment if couples want to do it. But just beware that, you know, it may, for the men especially, it may change what they do. And I will say, another thing that was fascinating to me about the experiment is that I was not allowed to say negative things. I couldn't. You know, do any, I couldn't criticize, which was crazy, you know, it drove me crazy. But at the same time, I was forced to say nice things. And then my wife would respond by saying something kind as well. And it was this vicious cycle of kindness. And it made me realize how much of our default mode in terms of conversation was sort of this bickering. And maybe the bickering starts out all in fun, but eventually it becomes a habit and it becomes unhealthy. So it was interesting to see when you take that away, and you know, it's there's something to be said for that. Bickering, I think, if it's your default mode, you should be careful.
And then you've got to tell about the chastity belt.
Well, this
the
one,
male chastity belt.
I'm afraid so. I found something while researching this on the internet that I did not know existed. It was it's a male chastity belt. It was an area, a product that I never knew there was a demand for. But apparently there is. And it comes, by the way, in 3 varieties, in case you want it. There's clear plastic, wood paneled, and camouflage, in case you want it.
And which did you get?
I went with the traditional clear plastic. But anyway, I thought if the experiment was that my wife would have control over my schedule and over, you know, my chores, why not give her control over my sex as well? She actually, it was interesting, that was an example of where maybe I've set the bar too high, because I showed it to her and she was totally unfazed. So maybe, you know, she...
That's right. She said something completely different, like, you know, nice curtains we put up or something. I mean, she said
right.
She didn't even notice.
She looked at it and she's like, huh. So anyway, back to... Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll shift from the chastity belt to George Washington.
Fair enough.
And there's a whole chapter. And how did you come up with this? Apparently George Washington, I guess he transcribed, somebody had written rules to live by and maybe added some himself. And maybe you could share some of the rules with us. But how did you even come up with this? So he dressed like George Washington. He lived by these rules that George Washington lived by. Maybe you could share some of the rules with us.
Well, it was I had not known this. I mean, I am interested in the Founding Fathers. I'd actually underestimated George Washington. I always thought he was the least interesting of the Founding Fathers. And now I believe that's the exact opposite. He's the most fascinating. And he wrote, when he was a young man, he wrote these 110 rules of civil discourse, which are basically these etiquette rules and on how to be civil and decent. And I can't believe in the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking about it nonstop, because it does seem like we've got a huge breakdown in civility. You know, Kanye West, Joe Wilson, Serena Williams, you know, it's just... I think that George Washington, he would have been appalled, and there does need to be a return to some of this dignity he talked about. And the rules span everything from the way you talk to each other, and no gossiping, no Schadenfreude. You don't want to feel, hooray when your enemy is destroyed. Table manners, it talks about. It even talks about that you shall not adjust your private parts. That's actually rule number two. Do not adjust your private...
I think there were two rules involving that, weren't there?
That's true. He repeats it later because it's so important.
In case you missed it.
Don't adjust them in public. So baseball players and Lil Wayne, for instance, he would be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I don't think of our founding father, first president, as being a little creepy, but that's a little... strange and creepy. What are some of the other rules that you followed yourself? Or what did you have trouble following?
Well, I guess I had trouble with, certainly the no gossiping. And it is hard to... he was an incredibly inspiring man. When he won the Battle of Trenton, he said that, he told his soldiers, do not cheer. History will huzzah for us, which is like... to me, an amazing display of restraint. And that's what makes him so remarkable to me, and why he was such a great leader. He was able to restrain himself. He had such self-discipline, because he was actually, naturally, he was very angry man.
He had a real temper, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a huge temper. Yeah. His assistant said, you can't, I believe, he swears a blue streak is what he said. So, but he knew that was a fault, and he was able to control his emotions. He was one of the most controlled, self-controlled people. And I think that is a true virtue, because he was, without it, I think he would never have been president. We would have lost the war, because he was also very impulsive, and he wanted to attack, but he knew that if he attacked, then the colonial troops would be wiped out. So he sort of played this long waiting game of attrition, so that eventually the British troops died by disease, and we were able to win. But it was all because he was able to control his natural urges.
By the way, I hope you all have some questions. We're about 4 minutes or so away from questioning, and if people, there's a microphone over here if you want to get up, and we prefer that you actually stand at the microphone and ask questions if you'd like to think about that. What was the most difficult rule for you to follow?
Of his?
Yeah.
No adjusting the crotch in public.
that was an obvious one. Did you actually dress like him at times anyway, or did you for the whole month?
I did. No, just for one day. I wanted to see what it was like.
Just for the picture in the book.
Basically, I wanted to explore his clothes, because I didn't know this, but he was a real clothes horse, and he believed that the clothes make the man. He was a lot about what we were discussing, this idea of the exterior makes the interior, and how important exteriors are. So he was very meticulous. He designed his own clothes. He dressed up like a general. He was the only one in military dress at the Continental Congress, because he wanted to be general. You know, there's that phrase by Jack Donaghy on the 30 Rock, dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And that's what George Washington did. He dressed like a general. They appointed him general. So he was very interested in clothes, and I thought that I would see what it was like. And it was actually quite nice. You know, I got lots of salutes and lots of, sir, a lot of bows. By the way, bowing is another one of the rules. You should bow. That's George Washington hated shaking hands. He refused to shake hands. He would bow. And now he seems extremely ahead of his time because with swine flu, now everyone's going to be looking like George Washington.
Yeah. So if he was dressing for the job he wanted, what were you angling for with this?
Well, I was just wanted to see what it would be like to dress in very, very formal clothing, because it was interesting to see also during this experiment the difference between Washington and Jefferson. So Washington, just on the clothes, he was very meticulous. Jefferson would answer the White House door in a bathrobe and slippers. So it was like these two opposite poles. And it's fascinating to see. I spent a lot of time with Washington groupies, these people who love Washington and just follow wherever he slept, they go. And they hate Jefferson. The animosity is still there 230 years later. You know, it's like, because Washington and Jefferson towards the end really did not get along. And these people think that Jefferson is a hypocrite, and because he did. He had a very different way of leading. Washington was all about actions, not words, and Jefferson really was the wordsmith. He was all about the beautiful language.
That's fascinating. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum, and tonight we're hosting My Life as an Experiment, A Year of Living Biblically and More. I'm David Ewing Duncan, Chief Correspondent for Public Radio's Biotech Nation and moderator for the evening, in discussion with A.J. Jacobs, author of The Guinea Pig Diaries, My Life as an Experiment, and he's an editor-at-large at Esquire. And we have a couple people here who have questions for you, A.J.
Yes, sir.
Let me jump right into that.
Good evening. Thanks. If any one of us wanted to do a shorter-term self-experiment, do you have any tips on how we could possibly dive into an area of interest
sure.
The way you have.
Well, I that was one of the themes of the book, is that I think everyone should be doing these experiments because everyone, you can really improve your life. And the way we get stuck in these ruts, and the way if you shake it up, you discover new things that make your life better. Even if it's you know, neuroscientists talk about these neural pathways, and if you drive to work every day, that that neural pathway becomes a rut. So even just try something as simple as driving a new way to work, and it sort of sparks the brain and makes you think in a new way. So little things, like as I said, changing your toothpaste, you know, give it a shot. You don't have to try radical honesty, but maybe try being totally truthful about yourself. Do it in little steps, because that's something I try to do. If you make a mistake, just be totally honest. I screwed up. I made a mistake. I actually think that our current president is pretty good about that. He's pretty radically honest. For a president about his mistakes. He says, I screwed up, I'm sorry, as opposed to our former president who never made any mistakes ever in his life. So just, you don't have to do the whole thing, just do little things, but I think it's a great way to keep your mind fresh and creative.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have a next question here.
Yes, I was wondering whether you could say something about your testing of your body for the chemicals in our environment.
Oh, that's better for David.
That's me. Yeah, this is more about AJ, but in my book, I was tested for several hundred chemical toxins out in the environment, pesticides, dioxins, things like that. And so mine was a little different.
How many did you find?
We detected almost 200 of them.
Wow.
And we all have them in us. And
in dangerous quantities?
That's open to question. They're in tiny little trace amounts. And obviously, I'm still walking around, and most of us are, but we do carry these chemicals in us in parts per billion, parts per trillion, and that's one of the big open questions that I pose in the book and many people are trying to grapple with right now is what those chemicals mean. Mm-hmm. And, are they dangerous or not? And there's some interesting science going on, actually, as I continue the book project, getting more and more into that kind of testing.
Interesting.
So, anyway, that's enough about me, though, so that AJ.
Thank you.
In the biblical year, you go through three phases of belief.
Right.
So when you were a believer, did you ever consider your conscience to be the voice of God?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. As you say, I went through these phases of belief because I started out as an agnostic, not knowing whether there's a God or not. But during the year, at times I believed very strongly in God, a very present and loving God. Other times I rejected God altogether. And in the end, the way I came out was I am agnostic, but I think I'm a very different kind of agnostic. A friend of mine who is a pastor, he calls it a reverent agnostic, which is a phrase I love, reverential agnosticism. Because my belief is whether or not there's a God, I believe in the idea of sacredness and that that our prayers can be sacred, and the Sabbath, which is one of the most profound of the experiences I went through in the Bible, that can be sacred. But yes, absolutely. When I was believing in God, then the conscience sort of was my voice, the voice of God.
Thanks. Can I ask the second one?
Why don't you step to the back of the line if we have time, get the other questions. By the way, AJ, you should try getting your brain scanned for belief in God.
I've heard about
that experience. It was very interesting. Ask if you
was it the
in
guy
God
in
the
Toronto? There was a guy in
no,
Toronto.
No, this is actually at the NIH. In fact, it's a very senior, well-known. He started with belief in sports and then moved into belief in God and other things. But anyway.
And do you believe in God? Did your brain believe in God?
Well, it was a tough question for me. I'm an agnostic too, but I can't entirely, being scientifically minded, you know, deny that there might be some intelligent force out there. So there was a brain, there was a huge storm going on in my brain during the MRI scan trying to answer that. Anyway, next question.
You mentioned earlier having children, but you didn't mention how they reacted to the various wild swings in your domestic situation. So could you talk a little bit about how they
sure.
reacted?
Sure. I have three children. I have a five-year-old, and I have during my biblical year, it says be fruitful and multiply. So I was fruitful, and I take my projects very seriously. So I had twin boys, and you know what? They are somewhat involved. I try to keep them out of it as much as possible, because I don't see them as guinea pigs. I see myself as the guinea pig. But it was interesting during the biblical year, for instance, the Bible in parts. And that's one thing I learned, is that you can never say the Bible says X or the Bible says Y, because the Bible says a lot of things. It's a very complex book that sometimes contradicts itself. So in parts, the Bible is very pro-discipline and pro-corporal punishment. So it says that you shall not withhold the rod. So you should hit your kid with a stick. So I didn't know how to deal with this, because that's not my parenting style. So I ended up using a Nerf rod, like a little Nerf bat, and I would hit my kid with that when he was bad. But then he would take a wiffle bat and hit me back. Like, he thought it was hilarious. He thought this was the greatest thing ever. So I was kind of like sanctioning violence. So in the end, that did not work out. But on the whole, I try to keep him out of the projects. Thanks.
So Nerf isn't actually in the Bible.
It doesn't mention one way or the other. Right?
In fact, what about the story of Abraham and Isaac? I was going to ask you about that with your kids. That never came up, did it?
Well,
He's asked by God to sacrifice his son.
That's right. I was never asked to sacrifice, so I kind of slipped through that one.
Good.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Next question.
When you were being radically honest, did difficulties ever come up with authorities? For example, did you ever, when otherwise to your boss, and he had an idea you thought was really bad, you might have said, oh, that's a good idea, but then came up with things of your own. Instead of that, you say, oh, that's really stupid.
That's a great question, and absolutely. I mean, it came up with my boss. You know, I would have to tell him exactly what I was thinking. You know, I would tell him, you know, I'd rather have another job. Right now, I'm bored with this job, and, you know, he... He didn't know what to make of that, even though he was the one involved. You know, I was writing it originally for the magazine. I remember also conflicts with my in-laws. You know, my mother-in-law gave me a present for my birthday, and it was a gift certificate. and I hate gift certificates. I told her, you know. She said, so how do you like your present? And I said, I had to tell her the truth. I think it's terrible. You know, to me, a gift certificate is like giving you an errand to do. It's like, here's something you have to do, another thing to fit into your schedule. I was like, thanks.
But AJ, couldn't you outsource this to
That's
to
a great
Penny?
Point. That is yeah. a great. It was one where you kind of had to show up in person, unfortunately.
It seems like you could have overlapped some of these.
Anyway, I did.
Yeah, next question.
Especially the year of living biblically, you're so profound and insightful into the Bible, a lot more so than many sermons I've ever heard. Have you ever been invited to speak at churches, evangelical or otherwise?
I have spoken at churches and at synagogues, and I love it. I was actually a speaker at the National Pastors Association, so it was like 2,000 evangelical pastors and me. So that which
what
one doesn't
say?
Belong? I told them what I felt about the Bible, because I felt, you know, certainly the Bible says to be honest. So I talked about the parts of the Bible I loved and how it moved me, but then the parts I really found problematic, and they were okay with it. You know, that's the other thing about I learned is not to stereotype. And you know, I had a very preconceived notion about evangelicals that they were all like Sarah, exactly like Sarah Palin, but they're not. It's a very broad movement. There's a group called the Red Letter Christians who say that Jesus never talked about homosexuality, so they are not going to discuss homosexuality. They're going to focus on what Jesus focused on, which is helping the poor and helping the outcasts, the lepers of society, whoever they may be now. So it's not a monolithic movement.
And didn't you get positive reviews in both an evangelical magazine and Penthouse magazine?
That was, yes. Yeah. I don't want to boast, because boasting's
yeah,
not.
Boasting is
but
bad.
That was very exciting. Yeah. Same month.
Question?
All right. In the Guinea Pig Diaries, the Radical Honesty chapter is called I Think You're Fat, but unless I missed it, I didn't see that story. Is there a story where you actually told somebody they're fat?
That is true. It is. That one was when I was with Brad Blanton. I asked him about this, because that's sort of the prototypical problem with radical honesty, is when the wife asks, do I look fat in this? And and I asked Brad, what do you do? And so we did a little role-playing game with me as playing my wife, and he was playing me. Does this make me look fat? And he goes, it makes you look like an effing whale. He didn't say effing, but he would probably consider to be lying, because I'm withholding. But anyway, he just laid into me and said that it was a terrible thing to ask. It showed my insecurity and that I should be courageous enough to be okay with being fat, and on. So it was like he attacked me. So that's what he wanted me to do to my wife if she ever asked.
Is this guy married?
He's been married 5 times. So that was a...
Boy, that's an endorsement, huh? Another question?
I was just wondering how you're finding the retention rate for the Encyclopedia Britannica stuff now that it's been 5 or 6 years. Is that information still kicking around? Does it still come up, or is it fading fast?
Well, there is... it's definitely forgotten a lot, a huge amount, you know, 97%, 98% maybe. But the stuff, there's so much stuff left in there, and I know it because I can't get it out. It's stuck. And unfortunately, a lot of times it's the most useless stuff, you know, like opossums have 13 nipples. That's stuck in there. You know, Rene Descartes has a fetish for cross-eyed women. That's in there. I can't get it out. I mean, the good thing is that I was able to retain something deeper from that project, which is that, well, a couple of things just quickly. One is that after reading the whole of human history, all our highs and all our lows, I really did come away more optimistic about our species, and I do believe that we have made real progress, and that that our highs have outweighed our lows. So it was a really affirming experience, even with the horrors of the 21st century, You think if you look at the long, long, long view compared to 5-10,000 years ago, when the chance of being killed by another human was, you know, one in three, one in four. You know, this we have made remarkable progress. So that was just one thing that has stuck with me, thank God.
And that was the first book. What was it, the Know-It-All?
That's right. It was called The Know-It-All, about reading the encyclopedia.
And you read the entire encyclopedia.
From A to Z. From ak, which is the first word, which is a type of Korean music, to zivich, and that's the last word. Well, I don't want to ruin the ending. In case you, if you haven't read it, I won't say.
I haven't read it yet, so you just blew it. Okay. Anyway. Well, your next book... You're working on it right now, right? It's called The Healthiest Human Being in the World. What's that about, if you want to talk about
sure.
it?
Sure. I mean, I'm very excited to talk to you because I think it overlaps a bit with your book, which I'm fascinated with. But this one is, this is sort of the final installment of my self-improvement series. This will be sort of the end of it, because I feel I've worked on my spirit with the Bible and my mind with the encyclopedia, so this is my attempt to improve my body. And I'm doing everything from my diet to working out to from top to bottom. You know, I was thinking I should have worn these shoes that I bought. I'm very excited about a new purchase. You probably have them in San Francisco. It seems like the place where they would have them. But these are... There's a movement of people who believe that we should be walking around barefoot because our feet were evolved to be barefoot. And so there's these... Have you seen those?
I've heard about them, yeah.
The gloves for the feet?
Yeah.
They're basically gloves for the feet.
Wrap around your toes.
Yeah, they wrap around your toes. And they look absurd. They're the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen. But wonderfully comfortable. I mean, it's like walking around barefoot on the street. It's just fantastic.
So are you doing anything right now with this book and making yourself healthier?
Well, I am.
Like, as we speak?
As we speak, you know, I'm drinking my room temperature water. One study said that room temperature water is much better for you because the absorption rate is higher. So as we speak, I'm drinking my water. I found some studies that coffee, that sort of are pro-coffee. So that's one thing I'm sure you've noticed. You can find studies to rationalize anything.
Absolutely, so, you know, and contradictory, too.
That's true.
Things are good, they're bad.
Right.
Yeah, so that's one of the fun things about it. Although I love coffee. And actually, coffee's quite good for you.
It has the antioxidants.
Excess, yeah. So when can we expect that?
Hopefully next year. I'm in the middle of it now, so I've... But I've got a ways to go because my body is quite imperfect. So,
are you aiming for perfection with this?
Well, that is what I'm open for. I mean, I've broken down health into three basic categories. One is longevity. So I have to hope I don't die during this year. That would be embarrassing.
Although great for the book sales.
That's true. That really would.
There's something really wrong with you. Believe me, I found this out. I'm ridiculously healthy. I think if I had found some horrible thing, you know, that's what gets you the attention. And we were talking about that earlier with our sort of psychotic journalistic proclivities. But
that's funny. Yeah, I'm sorry you're so healthy.
I know. It's been a problem with the book. Now, one of the things that intrigued me to round this up here is, you actually considered at one point, or I guess someone suggested having no human contact for a year, and you were trying to decide if this was a friend or not.
Right. Well, this was the one where I was not gonna. I was only gonna do it by Skype and Facebook, and my wife was the one who said, "No, that will not." But yeah, I'm not sure whether that was. I think it might have been my brother-in-law who suggested that because he can be the nemesis in my books. And just to end quickly on, he went to Harvard. He's incredibly smart, so he's an actual know-it-all, and he rubs it in. He's the most condescending man in America, he made fun of me throughout my year reading the encyclopedia, and was my nemesis. At one point during the year, though, towards the end, I got on the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And I write about it in the book. And I got to the $32,000 level, and it was a biology question. And he was a bio major at Harvard. So I'm like, all right, this is finally, he can do something for me. So I called him up, and he blew it. He did not know the answer. So it was a bittersweet moment because I lost $32,000. But at the same time, I may have humiliated myself on national television, but I brought him down with me. So that was a real, there's the pros and the cons. You ought to look on the bright side.
That radical honesty.
That's right.
I love it. Well, let's give a big hand to AJ.
Thank you very much.
And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.